Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I'm chatting with Kath Nibbs, who is a cyber trauma expert, human behavior technologist, PhD in cyber psychology, focusing on online harms and psychotherapy in the world of tech. She's also a podcaster, TEDx speaker, global educator, prolific author, and trauma psychotherapist. Welcome, Kath. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Kath, before we get into chatting about your work and your writing, can you tell us a bit more about your background, who you are, what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of cyber psychology, specifically the world of online trauma?
So in a nutshell, I have a background in tech. And as we were saying before, it is a word that lots of people use. So very quickly, I joined the army when I was 18. And I was the first woman to do my trade. And in that trade, which was called optronics engineer or instrument technician as well, was the title. That meant that I worked with day sights, night sights, lasers, power supply units, lots of forms of electronics. And that was before we became a global IT world. And pretty much after I'd got married, had my children, left the army, I went into the world of IT, as it was called then, and I worked for a large number of companies, and that would be Hewlett-Packard, Dell, Siemens, and it would involve going through to people's houses and businesses, so it was quite an interesting role. And if I go back to, this was pre-2000, one of the companies at the time was called Tiny Computers. And that even involved drilling through people's walls to connect wires to make sure that monitors could be connected to one central processing unit. We've moved away from that since then. We now have Wi-Fi and LAN cables and so on. And then the other part of it would be going into businesses, so casinos, petrol stations, banks, helping them with cybersecurity, making sure that their technology was working so I could fix, if you like, the outside and the inside of computers. And it was a full-on role. And what I found is that in those spaces, it would be, oh, we were expecting the IT guy. And I would have to say, I am the IT guy, which it wasn't from a sexist place. It was really, I would say it was more around the confusion around women being in this space and having the capabilities. And I kind of decided, right, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life because, you know, computers, in many times I've said, do sap your soul. So I moved away from computing and I went back to college and I started counselling and psychology in terms of these are the things that I'm really interested in, the why people do what they do. And that ties back to my early childhood. And my father was a radiographer in the prison service. And I live in Wakefield. So to give listeners and viewers a bit of context, we have in Wakefield the prison where the most heinous crimes are committed and people are committed to the prison here in what's called Category A. So as a young child, I was brought up with the horror stories of what happens in prisons. And I partly wanted to understand why people do what they do. And really, I found that when I got into psychology, I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. So much so that I then went on to do my A-levels and undergrad in psychology. I was going to go off and do a master's in cognitive neuroscience because I had a passion for biology, for understanding human behavior. And sadly, at the time, and I'd say it was around 2009, there wasn't really much funding for masters unless you had a PhD at the end of it or a job. And I kind of looked around and was like, well, what else can I do? I'd been through a divorce. I'd got children who were sadly victims of that divorce proceedings. And I decided I was going to go and do a better job of the child therapists that had I'd tried to engage for my children. And at the time, supplemented my income by becoming a relationships and sex education teacher. And lo and behold, it was kind of an amalgamation of all those factors whilst discussing, you know, relationships with children in schools. And I had children who were between 9 and 11. And I was hearing stories from these children which made my toes curl. And one of them in 2010 was it's called a snuff movie. So this is a real life murder that was taking place. And the children in the school would be talking about this particular movie, which they were sharing. So this is, let's just get into the smartphone debate quickly. They were sharing the URL of this particular website by writing it down on paper, by texting it to each other. And this is in the days when there weren't necessarily the ways to access things in your hand. They would then download the video. They would share it by Bluetooth because that was how things were shared in those days. And I was working with 11-year-olds, 16-year-olds, the variants in the secondary schools. All of those years would mention that they'd seen this particular movie. And I sat there going, okay, we need to do something about this. This is really difficult. And that's really where the word cyber trauma came from. And then I had a personal experience, both myself and my children, one of whom was sent the movie, one of whom came home and said, pretty much in the playground, we're all around the screen. And this, it was a journalistic murder that was taking place, that video was being shared. And I also had an experience of going on Facebook, seeing a video of a young child being chastised is an understatement. And when I complained to Facebook in the early days when it was Facebook, I was actually told that because the post was being shared and condoned, it didn't break community standards. And so really, that's where the why do people share this? Why do people do this? Why is this acceptable? How many children are seeing this? How many adults are seeing this? And that's really during my training as a psychotherapist, I started to explore the kinds of harms that happen to children. And sadly, it's taken over a decade for us to say, hang on a minute, I think these harms really affect people.
It sounds a bit like a rabbit hole that you've gone down. It's quite a dark rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Wow. And I wonder if this is part of what parents are worried about, and they see some of this, and this is maybe why there's so much talk around at the moment.
Yeah, well, I'm referring to it as hysteria, where you know, Jonathan Haidt, and this is, you know, very topical. Jonathan Haidt is saying, "Oh my goodness, children are seeing pictures of beheadings," and I'm like, partly I want to go get with the program. This was 10 years ago.
Yeah,
this is not a new thing.
Yeah,
however, the volume of this content and a conversation I had with one of my children the other week is we've gone from 360p to 4K. Yeah. So whilst I actually said to my son, it doesn't really matter about the quality of the content itself is difficult, it's traumatizing, and it is now something that most of the children in my practice will say, yeah, that's quite common, it's normal. And for me, that would be why we've got to have a real discussion about this. And that's what led to my PhD, which I've been, you know, wanting to do that particular piece of research since 2010.
Yeah. So it sounds as though there's a lot of desensitization that has gone on with the generation.
Yeah. Well, I'm not entirely sure whether it's a desensitization or whether it's a change in nervous system adaptability. So I tend to focus on the psychotherapy impact. Because in trauma work, a lot of people will say, no, it didn't bother me, which is the phrase that a lot of children use.
Wow.
And the desensitization is, for me, I pick up more about how people don't necessarily have interception and they don't necessarily recognize what they've watched, what has happened. And we know this from like witness trauma in domestic abuse and certainly in the emergency services, and I've worked with a lot of people who are in those roles who use the same kind of language.
Mm, wow. You've been really prolific in educating others in online harm, especially among children. You upload a lot of talks to YouTube and push these out through your social media channels. How on earth do you continuously produce so much useful content?
That's possibly down to my social media manager. So I don't myself physically spend a lot of time on social media. I don't have time. But I would certainly say there is a lot about my activism is to write, to teach, to educate. And I found the way to do that is short form video, long form conversation, writing books, and to get this PhD absolutely finished and signed off.
Yeah. So talking about your books, you focus on children, technology and healthy development. And you've written quite a few books already relating to how online harm. What got you started being a writer?
Now, I think everybody says, again, it's one of those, everybody says, it's a grandiose statement, we've all got a book in ourselves. Mine came from, so the PhD is very specific, and I'm sure you know that in academia, you tend to focus on one specific aspect. And yet, because I've been working with children directly for maybe 14 and a bit years now, with this kind of stuff, and the stuff is, I think I'm down... probably around 67 different types of harms that we can face. And that would be because there's so much lexicology and typology and taxonomy around all of this stuff anyway. But there was something about, I don't always have time to educate, for example, social workers, police. And I wanted people to understand that there's more to the event than the idea of it is social media, it is technology. This is about human behaviour in a world of technology. And it's not a correction to you. It's a correction to, unfortunately, the books have been titled that they're about children. They're not about children. They're about everybody. That happens to be more of a publishing approach, really.
Okay, that's great to know, because your titles are Children Technology. So who have you written them for? Is it for adults, for children, for social workers, for therapists? Because you've mentioned that slightly in your previous comments.
Yeah. So in the first book, I'm actually talking about, so I had a client who was in his 50s using tracking technology on his partner. So I discuss that particular aspect in the first book. And it was to say, why does this person do this? Well, actually, it goes back to attachment, and it goes back to fear of being rejected, abandonment, the kinds of relational processes that he had going on, and what that really meant for him in a bigger aspect. So it wasn't necessarily this was a 55-year-old man tracking his girlfriend. This was about a man who was worried, terrified, had lots of attachment issues from his childhood. And here it was playing out with the technology that allowed him to do something that you couldn't do as a child. Well, you can now, because obviously you can track your parents with all sorts of technology and so on. But it was really, it's really the child in the adult in the world of today, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And it sounds as though it's about helping both the victim and the person who's created or who's perpetrating the crime, let's call it, understand themselves and understand the other person so that they can better deal with it, both from why are they doing this to me or why am I doing this, and find ways then to rectify that behavior.
Yeah, well, that became, so in the first book, I talk about something called blue tick distress. And this is that WhatsApp phenomena around, has somebody seen my message? Am I important? Why are they not responding to me? And if you go back to, this is kind of what I talked about in the TEDx conversation, was if you go back to children who are mummy, 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 daddy, 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 teacher, 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 and they're not seen and they're not recognised and they don't feel important, actually that then starts to play out in forms of anxiety. And certainly I've been left on unread, or I've been left on read and not answered, is one of the most prolific conversations that takes place in the therapy office.
Wow. And it is about how you read someone else's behavior.
Yeah.
Especially when it's asynchronistic and you can't see why they're doing it. And they may be super busy and they just haven't, or they've left their phone behind.
But oh, absolutely.
In a completely different context.
Yes. And that's one of the things I facilitate with many of the clients is, okay, let's have a look at the reasons for somebody not replying immediately. Let's have a look at the reasons for somebody not responding to you in the moment. And what could that be? And is that a you problem or is that a them problem? Is it a co-created problem? Is this a way of somebody communicating to you that actually maybe you've made them uncomfortable? Or is this now what we call ghosting? So, you know, it's really complex.
Because it could be a power dynamic from the person not reading the text.
Oh,
and
yes.
Ghosting and just kind of going, I'm going to show you. It's a way of subtle
yes.
power.
Yeah.
Fascinating world of technology and messaging. And you've got another book that is coming out soon called Managing Your Gaming and Social Media Habits, which I'm desperate to read. So how is this book different from what others have written?
I mean, this is the first in a series, and it's called the British Psychological Society Ask the Expert series. So no pressure in writing it. And where now it's being published in October. I really wish it had been published a couple of months ago to combat and counteract the height hysteria. Again, the book is more an educative journey about why we do what we do online. Why do we engage in the behaviours that we do? What is it that drives that? And a lot of the time, it's attachment, relational, the way we perceive other people, the kind of superimpositions we put in place. Oh, they're ignoring me because they don't like me. And lots of people use their technology without being aware of why they're using their technology. So again, it's a conversation I have in the therapy room. And this is really a book about really finding a way to have intentional use of this technology, which, you know, crept into our lives. And it's become so ubiquitous that many of us didn't realize that we have the habits that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of a Trojan horse that's come in without anyone realizing impact. And suddenly it's taken over and we kind of go, oh my word, what's going on here?
Uh-huh.
Now we're having to deal with that and we can't really close the gates because it's already in.
Yeah. And the ironic, and I'm using the it is ironic in terms of the adults that are shouting from the rooftops about, we need to stop children on this technology, this technology is harmful. Actually, I think some of that has come from the finger pointing that's happened from this, you know, all technology is bad, social media is bad. And certainly what I'm witnessing is a cohort of grown-ups that have been told they are the problem by giving this technology to children. And when people are shamed, when people are victimized in this way, they take a reactive space and they become defensive and angry and even more scared. And this is what we tend to do as people is, okay, well, let's take away the bad thing. And then I'm not perceived as being a bad parent.
Yeah. And to be able to say something, someone else is at fault, not me.
Absolutely. And then we've done this, and I'm sure that there's many cyber psychologists that are saying this. We've done this so many times over so many different products and things and spaces. Yeah. And I often say to people, do you remember when MTV was going to create a culture of sexualized children and that didn't happen? Well, there is a little bit more to say that within this space at the moment, there are influences. I know because that's what I write about and I see that in the therapy office, but it's not everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So just one thing I want to touch on about this book that's coming out. It's gaming and social media. A lot of people say that boys game and girls on social media. Is that true?
Not in the literature. So and bearing in mind, there is the academic literature, there is grey literature, and then there's kind of the panic literature, which is the social media space. So the academic literature is pretty much finding there's a 50-50 split for gaming and there's a 50-50 split for social media. And we are in a world where social media is a complicated construct in itself. So again, I don't see that there are sex differences. I see that people use technology in different ways. And of course, we can't have the direct split between boys and girls because we now live in an environment, a world, where there is a myriad of people who do not identify in either of those spaces and in either of those taxonomies.
Yeah. So it's more, do you think, about the behavior, the things, internal things that are driving behavior, not about whether they're male, female, whatever the gender identification is, and however old they are. It's about what is driving me internally to do this behavior. And do you think there's something different about gaming and social media that makes it more or less, let's call it addictive for the sake of a better word?
I mean, it's the modus operandi. So gaming is more about a particular action. So there's more, let's call it play, involved. And within play, you would be looking for things like autonomy and mastery and disconnect from particular things. And social media is exactly what it says on the tin. It is about socializing in whatever format, which includes the voyeuristic watchers, the voyeuristic, space in which you can be, where gaming is more intrinsic to the person. Social media can be the nosy neighbor. It can be people who are covertly watching other people's behavior. It can be used for people to have discussions, people to have debates, people to really just connect. And this is something we've done for a very long time. And in the first book, I talk about this is going to show my age. When I was smaller, it was pen pals. You wrote a letter to somebody, and the only time you knew that that person had received that letter was when you got the return one back in the post.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that as well. I had pen pals. It was so exciting getting a reply. But because I think that, thank you for explaining that, because I think a lot of people kind of lump social media and gaming together and don't kind of look at the different reasons why we use those two different formats. So thank you for that. Now, when is your book coming out? You said October, but when specifically? And can we pre-order it?
Yes. So you can pre-order it on Routledge, and you can pre-order it on Amazon, and I suspect many other book suppliers. And I think it's 17th of October at the moment, the date.
Oh, fabulous. Right. I'm going on straight after this to pre-order that. I'm very excited to read that. Okay. So you have a podcast that's called the Cyber Synapse Podcast. Who is it aimed at, and what kind of topics do you cover? What objectives do you have? And what kind of people do you talk to in your podcasts?
So the podcast began as kind of an amalgamation of people, technology, and how technology can be used for health and well-being. So I dare not use the word biohacker, okay? So I'm a functional health practitioner, and what I actually see in the world of technology that allows us to look at our health and well-being takes you into the realms of, so I can do what's called epigenetic testing on my clients. And what that allows through technology is, in its most basic format, I can do DNA testing with my clients to find out what's called a nutrigenomic profile. So this is around pathways in the body that are indicative of later life issues, the major chronic illnesses, which are cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and cancer. But also it helps me work with people who have autoimmune diseases, for example. And in the world of trauma, there was this word thrown around in 2010, 2011, epigenetics and methylation. And I wanted to know what that was. So when I set about doing the podcast, it was around how can we use technology to assess what's going on? How can we use technology for helping us improve our own well-being? And that includes wearables. So I am a person who wears a Whoop band. I used to wear the Oura Ring, but I actually found that the Whoop band gives me better metrics. How can we use technology to help us understand heart rate variability? So I've been using HeartMath software for about 11, 12 years now. That helps me work with my clients and help them find a way to manage their stress, a way to manage and be resilient by taking care of themselves. And really, the podcast was, okay, let's have a look at how technology can help us and also how technology can ail us and what the issues might be. So it covers cybersecurity, technology, behavior. And most of the people I talk to are either in two sides of the camps. They're either somebody who understands technology or somebody who understands human behavior. And really, they are episodes of information for teachers, therapists, social workers, police, maybe parents, you know, because quite often parents are practitioners and practitioners are parents. And a lot of it tends to be around where the technology is coming in. So one of the episodes I've done is around AI in psychotherapy settings. I've done episodes around how we can use heart rate variability software. Some of them around cybersecurity, data protection. So pretty much all of the books that I've been writing, they're the kind of people that I've spoken to.
Oh, fantastic. How can someone listen to or watch your podcasts?
So the audio versions are on iTunes, they're on Spotify. I think that's, I would say, all major retailers of the, you know, it's the usual places. But I also record them in video format, and most of them are now sitting on a concentrated YouTube channel because I was spread all over in different places. So I do have a YouTube channel, and on there I'm moving the podcast episodes because I've been doing this since about 2017. Wow. And, you know, I'm not trying to be a Joe Rogan. I'm trying to be a repository of information, which is quite evergreen, because one of the early episodes I did was with a police officer, and we talked about using technology while you're driving and the kinds of issues that presents, such as accidents. Now, now we're looking at so many of the issues around GPS in cars and what that can track and who can really see your data. So it's been a myriad of conversations, and they are all being uploaded into one YouTube channel at the moment.
Brilliant. And I'll provide a link to that YouTube channel in the notes.
Just to say, I do fall into my remit of sweary Kath because A, I'm from the military, but B, there is also sometimes when I say things and, you know, a swear word is the only thing that will suffice in the moment.
Isn't it about being human?
Oh, absolutely.
For sure. And you've also done a TEDx talk, which is amazing and so informative. But you talk about the three sisters and how this relates to our approach to technology use. And you also mentioned the relationship provocateur. Can you give us a summary of what you mean by these terms? And I will also provide a link to the TEDx talk. It's amazing to watch.
So I think what we tend to do in technology is we try to find a technological solution to a human problem. And that's currently where we are in terms of the Online Safety Act. It's where we are in terms of GDPR. It's where we are in terms of software that can monitor, and certainly in the world of child sexual abuse material, which we call CSAM, using AI to capture and remove much of that material. What we often forget, and you know, I think this is way before Freud. This is going probably back to Aristotle and, you know, really, really far back. We tend to forget the why we do what we do. So the three sisters is a metaphor. I've heard many, many people talk about, you know, the three sisters is a story about three sisters see babies floating in the river, and one of the sisters wants to jump in and rescue the babies. The other one wants to teach them how to swim. And I'm suggesting that we go upriver and we take the approach of, well, let's find out why people fall into this river. Why do they fall into, as I call it, the stream of digital data, which is now 28 years of age in terms of the internet? Why don't we go and really start where the problem is, which is, why do people do what they do? And the whole premise of the TED Talk is a personal reflection. And it was based on, I can't remember how old my children were. I think it was when the iPad mini came out. So, and the reason I say that is because I remember that I'd got the iPad mini sat on my knee and I was doing extra work. I was on the iPad and I was like, look at me doing my emails after work. Aren't I a good person? As you do. And I realised I hadn't spoken to my children for nearly an hour and they hadn't spoken to me either. So the relationship provocateur is any piece of technology that gets in the way of a relational process, a relationship. And what I've started to see pretty much in the last 10 years is that children's attentional time in terms of eye-to-eye contact in the therapy room changed, and it has been changing. And children are now more gregarious. They seem to want your attention in much more of a demanding way. And I put that down to something that I call in my first book, e-tachment. So it's a changing way of the attachment process, because we've gone from the standard 1950s 2.4 nuclear family, as it was called, into a space of mum, dad, and the thing. And the thing is used as a way to engage with babies. And that's when I hear most of the mother ease. It's when I see lots of conversation taking place. And if that's the case, then what has this piece of technology done to that relationship? And I'm well aware that it is a provocateur. It changes the dynamic of how we connect.
Yeah, connect with other humans.
Yeah.
Mm. And how we connect with ourselves, I'm guessing, as well.
Oh, certainly. So there's lots of intrapsychic processes about I'm only important when I've got the right filter on and when I've said the right thing and if I'm in the right space. And that's certainly something I've said in the book coming out. When I first began in this space, I did try to ally with a lot of the academics that had the same viewpoint as me. And I got in the middle of what I call the Great Atlantic Debate. And I only wanted to hear what matched what I was seeing in my office. And that's not a way to be a good researcher. It's not a way to be a balanced human being. And those critical thinking skills usually only happen in relationship when you can ask questions and you can create that kind of thinking.
Yeah. So we hear a lot of talk about the echo chamber that AI creates.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it takes quite a bit of courage to step out of that echo chamber like you have and just saying, actually, there is another side of the arguments and I want to hear other viewpoints. And even if it kind of conflicts with what I think and what I completely believe, it's a lot of courage actually to listen to someone else and hear them.
Yeah, and it can often jar, and certainly I am a feather ruffler in the space of saying, well, where's the evidence for that? So for example, one of the statements I hear used a lot by some of the media, generally in the US, is, for example, the social media documentary. What was it called? The Social Dilemma. In terms of this is the way to the And it's phrases like, this is the shortcut to the base of the brain. You know, this is the limbic system hijack. And I want to know where the evidence for that is, because I cannot find it in the literature. It's a grandiose statement that's scary. But also, I see statements like, well, they don't do this in China and Silicon Valley. Where's the evidence? And when I start to ask those questions and say those things, it feather ruffles for sure.
Yeah. So you've done a talk called The Real Social Dilemma. What do you cover in that? And because you kind of compare it to the Social Dilemma movie.
Yeah, well, that's what the TEDx is it's about bodies and brains. And what I'm really alluding to is not only what we do on technology, but also the things that have changed, such as the way we connect with people. And I do see technology demonized. It's not the same. You can't connect with people in that way. So I've been doing online therapy for a long, long time. And I can tell you, you do connect with people. What you don't necessarily get is the same energetic feel that you would when you sit in a room with a person. And that's, I'm gonna start sounding like a psychotherapist if I go off into this domain too much. But there is something about, we are electromagnetic beings. We are vagal to vagal communicators. We know this. Because I give an example when I'm doing my training of, have you ever walked past somebody and just gone, oh, I don't know why I don't like them, but I don't like them. or that person gives me the heebie-jeebies. And that comes from a deep knowing around interception, what Stephen Porges calls neuroception. And whilst that's omitted through technology spaces, there are other indicators. And for me, it's a different medium and a different way in which we're evolving. And really, I think that's the social dilemma that we're struggling with, is we don't necessarily get the same points of, I'm going to call it a warning. We don't get the same points of warning about the content that we're engaging in. And to give a quick reflection, I'm not spoiling my TEDx here, but when we hold babies in the most intimate conversation that ever begins, their very first few moments of life, it's at a particular distance. And lo and behold, that's the same distance we hold our smartphones, we touch our smartphones. It's the same distance we're probably sitting now at the computer. And that is an inherent knowledge of safety. So I call it the false zone of safety in the first book, because what I'm talking about is the neurobiological processes that happen. And this is why we can be so reactive to people online, because we are bodies and brains, and quite often we're bodies before brains, and reactive and responsive, and we're not necessarily getting the same kinds of signals. Now, that is going to completely change with VR, and it is changing with VR, and I am seeing that already.
Yeah. So we're not able to read that because it just doesn't exist with the 2D level of technology interaction.
Yeah.
But we'll do with the 3D like VR.
Yeah. And that, so anybody that got the PS4 VR, right, when that first came out, there was a set of games that came out. And this was my first, moment was, I think the game was called Luge. So you're on a little board and you're going down a hill. And one of the points of the game, you actually go up on similar to a humpback bridge. And what I noticed is it felt like my stomach lifted as it would do on a humpback bridge. But then I didn't get the gravitational pull, which you get in the real world when you come down the other side. And that left me going, this is really... So we're going through another complexity of immersive empathy. We're going to go through spaces where our bodies are going to change in the environment, and we're going to recognize it's not quite real, but it is real. And yeah, that fascinates me. And I would love to do that's post PhD. That's more about, let's get the cyber psychologists in on this. That's fascinating, and a space where I would love to understand the immersive way in which our brains understand immersive technology.
Yeah. And how we interact with others, and how we interact with ourselves, and how we evolve in that process.
Yeah.
Wow. Just such a new fascinating area. So you touched on your PhD and you're currently finishing off your PhD in online harms and psychotherapy. What got you started on this journey?
That was the 2010 children watching these horrible types of material. So the PhD is focused around what we now might call online harm, inappropriate material. And what I've done is gone out and talked to primary school age children. I want to go, luckily, well, it's not luckily, it's a privilege. I have the skills to talk to children in a trauma-informed way, which, to be honest, hasn't happened in any of the safety literature to date. Many people ask children questions which are re-traumatizing, and it's not facilitative to a child's point of view and phenomenology. So what I did was I went in and I spoke to these children about what they've seen, and it's... excuse my French, a no shit Sherlock piece of research. They are affected by the things that they see that are not okay. And, you know, there's been some absolutely wonderful moments from seven-year-olds making statements like, well, the tech shouldn't allow that stuff on for us to see in the first place. And they should make sure we are who we say we are, out of the mouth of babes.
Exactly that. Yeah. And I think this generation is going to grow up with that. And they will probably be the ones who put their foot down and say, enough. We've been exposed to it. This is not okay. And I won't
be
exposed to this.
Certainly. Now, I don't quite like the way we label people, but certainly the Gen Z, and certainly the ones that are, I'm going to say 27 and under, are starting to say things like that, like, hang on a minute. And one of the things I will say here is we've failed a generation of children hugely. And my children are first generation internet users. They had not a helicopter parent, but a parent who took an interest in what they were doing and has watched the evolution of this kind of material, the forums, you know, the 4 and 8chans, certainly the Reddits, and the places where opinions and the kinds of, I've always said, if there's a thought that's been funk, it exists on the internet. And of course, that means that we've been exposed to the darker side of human behaviour, which is something that I wrote about in 2016 on a Kindle book, and I called it The Darker Side of the Internet. It hasn't covered enough of what exists, and that's really how I got into the PhD, because what I would say is these 7, 8, 9, and 10-year-olds are seeing things that the adults wouldn't comprehend as being excessively violent or excessively inappropriate. They're affected by fairly mundane issues. And I recently had, so just to give an example, I recently had a parent phone me up about their 6-year-old child who had watched YouTube Kids. They'd watched a Peppa Pig episode, and on the Peppa Pig episode, how do I put this politely? Peppa Pig had removed her skin, and this child was now incontinent, not sleeping, having nightmares, unable to concentrate in the classroom. And that is a cartoon version of something that we would be saying, well, actually, under the Online Safety Act, we would be looking at violent material in this particular format. Well, this is the same as Tom and Jerry, as Scooby-Doo, as Pokemon, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Wow.
And it's not uncommon. A lot of the children I work with are frightened by things. So let's go with not Momo, because that was a bit of a hoax, but they're frightened by things that appear in the gaming environments, such as Fuzzy Wuzzy or Huggy Wuggy, should I say. It started off as other things that they get upset by are the violence that take place in Roblox and Minecraft. We're not talking high-end 18-plus rated movies, even though some of the children I worked with that were 7 and 8 have watched 18-rated movies because they now have access to video on demand.
Do you think parents are aware that their children are watching these?
To give a balanced answer, some are not.
Okay.
And that's mainly because, and I think this is why we've got such a reaction at the moment, and I can't remember which book I've put this in, we made an assumption that the internet was going to keep our children safe in the same way that we do education does. And that's not any fault of a parent. It's the naivety of, well, if it's an environment that's been created for children, it is likely to be safe, because surely nobody set out to create an environment that was going to be harmful to children. And I am going to say in favour of big tech, Mark Zuckerberg never set out for Facebook to be an environment that hurt and harmed kids.
Yeah, agree.
And what we've done is we've demonised Meta and Snapchat and TikTok as places where children get harmed. And again, I go back to, and that's because people, and humans will always human. And these are environments where humans are in connection with other humans. And yes, the access to children is now much, much easier for perpetrators than it ever has been or ever would be in the corporeal world.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of things are set up and kind of quite innocently or just for very different reasons and then they actually evolve to become.
Yeah.
The bigger they get, the harder it is to control, the harder it is to make sure that people aren't harmed.
Yes. And the counter argument to that is, well, let's just go with Elon Musk's the town hall. I usually use a metaphor of either a shopping centre or perhaps a city park. I normally talk about a city park. Lots of these activities would not be allowed in the real world. And what we've, I don't know whether to say failed to understand or we don't understand because we don't understand. This is that not knowing and knowing, the unknown unknown, is in the space of cyber, in the space of virtual online or whatever label we give it, we haven't recognised that that's where people's thoughts, desires, wishes are enabled, because it's a space in which, you know, to go back to John Sula's phrase of we've got the online disinhibition effect.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we don't realize that when we're engaging on stuff that we are enabled by this technology, and it makes it so easy for people to be disinhibited online, and we don't recognize that. Mm-hmm. And I often use the kind of example of, you wouldn't have someone coming up to the street and saying, well, can I have your email address, your phone number and your address? You'd go, no way, but you happily give it away online because we don't think about that as a...
And sadly, I think the campaigns to educate parents are victim blaming. They are aggressive. And again, I'm not necessarily convinced that the people doing it are coming from a place of using research. So this is one of the other things I see. So, you know, don't let your kid, that is very shouty, finger pointing, capital letters. And what that results in is exactly what we've got going on at the moment, which is fear, shame. And in those moments, that's where people will, you know, to go with neuropsychology for a moment, that's where people shut down. They don't want to listen and they go into it. Don't tell me, don't tell me, don't tell me. And it's frightening. And what we're not doing is we're not facilitating parents. And this is why I use that phrase, ogres in the screen. And it's about understanding, if you knew there was ogres in the screen, you might do things differently. And if I give you the information about who these ogres are and where they live and what they do, you are then empowered to have a conversation with your child about, no, you can't go on that particular game because there's violence in that game. And that game, you know, isn't suitable for children because it's been decided so by these pieces of research or by these organisations. And yes, I am going to have, I don't know, some software on the phone that helps me know where you are, because it's, and I'm just going to quote here what I said to my children. It's not about me not trusting you. It's about me understanding there's people I don't trust in the world. And those people might want to harm you. And my job as a parent, or my job as a therapist, or my job as a teacher, whoever it is to make sure that you're safe at every opportunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the thing, is helping children understand why parents are doing what they do and why they say no and why they're tracking, rather than just you shall be tracked, you shall not.
There seems to be a lot of authoritarian type approaches of, well, I've called this spyware, in terms of parents are doing it with the best of intent, but not always with the best of outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely. For everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kath, you're a trauma psychotherapist. Do you do a lot of private practice work? Would you work with the NHS? Yes. Do you educate other therapists? What kind of therapy do you do generally?
So, in a nutshell, I'm a trauma psychotherapist in private practice. And much of my work at this point in time has evolved into, yes, I get a lot of phone calls about certainly technology, intimate image sharing, working with families where there has been contact by family of origin. So these might be children in kinship, children who are adopted. So I do work around adoption issues. And much of my work at the moment is working with children who have in utero trauma. And that's very complex. But certainly what happens in their early years, and certainly while they're in primary school, is their use of technology is there's more vulnerabilities, and therefore the vulnerabilities that they have when they're in the online space are not necessarily recognised. So some of the children live with grandparents who are so technophobic, frightened, don't understand the technology whatsoever. And these children are exposed to the online space that we all are, and those vulnerabilities are exploited much more quickly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
I'm trying to keep both confidentiality and shock factor to a minimum there.
Yes. That's tricky to do. You do. So I'll be including links to all your media videos and books in the notes, but what is the best way for people to get in touch with you if they're looking for someone to help them with online trauma?
So, I mean, I do a lot of trading. Again, I'm going through that. I'm updating the website and bits and pieces like that. So I have a website, which is childrenandtech.co.uk. And on there, you'll find lots of different types of resources or pointing you towards things like my polyvagal video, the TEDx video, the books, some of the resources that I've created, trainings. And most people, I would say, follow me on Instagram and TikTok. They're the two main places. It can be a little bit volatile on TikTok, as we all know. And Twitter, I don't really have that many followers. But then again, that's because I don't spend a lot of time on Twitter. I went through, or X, it's now X. I went through the phase, as most people do, of getting into debates. And I've actually found it's not the place for me to communicate to parents, to professionals. So I'm also on LinkedIn, where I take the TikTok and Instagram videos, and my social media manager, we put them on LinkedIn as well.
Okay. So across various different platforms to reach various different people.
Yeah.
Brilliant. What is the question, Kath, the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
I think for all of us, it's why do we use the technology in the way that we do? And that would certainly be, so if you were to ask me that, mine initially was I wanted to see what everybody else was doing. I wanted to be popular. That was why I joined Facebook in 2007, as everybody else did. And I went onto Twitter, and it was, I wanted to educate. So a lot of the pattern that I've had was early use of technology was to be in those spaces, to find out who was doing what. But what I would say now is I don't spend as much time on social media, mainly because I'm saturated, and I think a lot of people are saturated. And I would certainly say my use of social media now is educative.
Yeah, absolutely. Agree. There's too many ads. There's not, it just feels like you're being bombarded by things you don't really want to look at.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm also sitting there thinking, but my use of technology in the therapy office is such an, I mean, just using gaming with young children is such an insight to their internal processes, that understanding how a child plays Fortnite has been one of the most interesting ways I can use another medium to understand how a child perceives the world. And that's the bit that I want to communicate to professionals.
Wow. Because there is a lot of play therapy that involves physical things like blocks and crayons. So it's very fascinating that you're using games, online games, to do that.
Yeah. And well, just to give a quick example, and I know it's just kind of like there's a time thing here, but I'm gonna add this in. There are many ways to play Fortnite, for example. Okay, so one of the children who was in the therapy office was what I call a camper. He would sit on the outside of the map and only ever move to the middle. So if you know the story of Fortnite, you're 100 people that begin the game, and that basically you've got to triumph and be the winner, right? Now, the way you do that is you either go in and kill as many people as you can to get to the center away from the storm, or you do what this particular client did. He did not like conflict. He came from a family where there was a lot of domestic abuse, so he would hide and wait. And that was his strategy in Fortnite, which allowed me to understand this is his strategy in the real world. He will stay out of the way until it's absolutely necessary to be in a space where there is, in Fortnite, the engagement with other team members, or in the case of Battle Royale, he was against others. But actually, when it came to cooperative play with his peers, so if he was doing the squad version, he couldn't do that. He couldn't understand social cues as they are in the game. Versus a little boy who will, you know, pretty much tell me, this is what I'm doing on social media. This is what I'm doing on VR. This is how I play this game. This is what you need to understand about this. So he spends a lot of time trying to educate me. And that's his communication way. He does not know how to have a conversation, but he is very good at explaining what's happening and how to understand, you know, what he's doing in Minecraft and what that means for other children and what that means for building a server. And his presentation is more around, I don't know how to have a conversation with you unless it's me talking about the thing that fascinates me. And that is because he's neurodivergent And he has ADHD and he's got in utero trauma, and he is just not equipped to spend time with other children because his trauma reactions get in the way and he can become quite aggressive. So this is his safe space. And for me, this is why I am so anti the let's remove it all dialogue that's currently overtaking the space at the moment.
Yeah, I think you've given a real good insight into how this could be used in a really constructive way rather than one big brush of it's rubbish and gaming is making young boys kill everyone. There's so many different ways to use something. It's like, I guess a knife can kill someone, but also it can be really helpful to prepare food. So not use it in the way that's meant to be used and find other ways to make it more useful.
Yes, and just as a reflection, so I've talked about this in the book that's coming out. I've never had a child who's had sand tray addictive violent disorder. And let me tell you, the stories that get played out in the sand tray are violent. They are incredibly violent. And that is a way that a child plays in a third person perspective to show me what happens in their life on many different levels. So the unconscious as well as the conscious. But this is what children use games for. It's another medium and it's another form of I get to be triumphant and I get to be the person who kills the dragon, for example, which happens a lot in Minecraft.
Yeah, being the hero.
Yeah.
Yeah, because every boy wants to be a hero and often every girl wants to be a hero of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Kath. So just kind of finishing up, there's one question I always ask guests is around the frustration a lot of cyber psychologists feel around media misinformation that often takes academic findings and then sensationalizes them to foster either clickbait articles or moral panic or negative social narratives around digital technology. Do you think this is getting better or worse?
I've yet to find, how do I do this? Right. I've yet to find a journalistic reporting or a mainstream media reporting of this is complicated, this is nuanced, it's multifaceted, this is a human being, and we cannot say X equals Y. And yes, I certainly, having studied the media ethics around, and again, this is part of the PhD learning that I've had, is actually there are different ethics for the media. And I would certainly say that the media wouldn't be able to be as successful if they told a truth or the truth, depends on your own framing. But certainly, pretty much the findings from any kind of research, whether this is the medical space, is generally, it's multifaceted, it's complicated, it's nuanced. This is because every person is different in a slightly different way. I mean, this is going back to individual differences, isn't it, in terms of the psychology literature. And we don't talk in that way. But I would love to see the positive psychology movement and the mainstream media work together.
Yes, agree. Absolutely. I wonder if that's going to happen in the next kind of 5 to 10 years where we start to shift our perspective of technology use to being about as human psychology, human behavior, rather
than
the digital medium being this enemy of the state. And actually it's about how we use it and how it affects us. Oh, that'd be so great.
Yeah.
So I like your perspective of positive psychology. I think that's
really that's because I've been off and done a little bit of training in and around it. And I would certainly say if anybody wants a nice summer book to go and read, I would definitely have a look at Transcend by Barry Kaufman.
Which answers the next question I have to you about what favourite cyber psychology book you'd recommend.
Do you know that, I mean, the cyber psychology books are... Certainly, they tend to be domain or topic specific. And, you know, I do have the handbooks and the books by, she's now a professor, Professor Linda Kay.
Yes.
I quite like, in the books that I've read, Pete Etchell's most, and it's really interesting. So my yellow book, as I'm calling it, is almost the same as Pete Etchell's books, but it's a bit more about... it's really about the human behaviour behind why we do what we do rather than this is what the science says. And I do tend to tell people to go and read that at the moment. And I managed, luckily before the printing stage, to get a paragraph in saying, I wish I'd had his book whilst I was writing this.
Brilliant. Absolutely. I love that book. particularly in your one too. Can't you watch
Thank you. I wanted this book to hurry up so much, and anybody who's ever written a book knows that it takes a long time to get to print. And yeah, the book was handed in 2023. So it's something that I was like, oh, come on, Jonathan Haidt's getting everybody upset and frightened and scared. And yeah,
come on, launch.
But in terms of actually, yeah. there's a reflection in terms of the mainstream media. Actually, I'm going to talk about podcasts for a second.
Yes.
Jonathan Haidt has been able to get on the biggest podcasts of the biggest speakers.
Yes, he has.
And I'm going to use the word pontificate in terms of actually his understanding of technology and cyber psychology is minimal and massively. And I have seen recently the conversations about, did you know that there are gangs that sextort children? And I've been doing this for 14 years. Actually, he's had the platform to talk about this, which is why I'm calling it the Haidt hysteria. And we're not having good communication about this because, you know, I think that Pete Etchell's book should be in the same space in terms of sales and conversations as the Jonathan Haidt one.
Agree. I think the difference between them is, because one is slightly more academic. Pete Etchell's one is more academic. It can be slightly harder to read because it doesn't have as many stories as Jonathan Haidt's does. But also, and Jonathan Haidt is more a social psychologist, so he talks about it from a story perspective.
And
that background and why, what is the technology behind the technology?
And that was, yeah, so that's a line it definitely in my book is I had to do, now I was attacked on social media by a neuroscientist telling me I didn't understand neuroplasticity, I didn't understand the work of Twenge and Haidt, and I had to kind of roll my eyes and be polite, but also go, that's because they don't read the research either. And actually, having taken a deep dive into both sides of it, I find it really interesting that social psychologists are anecdotal in a lot of the stories that they use, and there isn't the evidence. But also, when we start getting into the quant, it gets so complicated that I got confused. And sometimes I was looking at pieces of research going, how the heck is the general public supposed to understand this? So what I've actually talked about is, this is really complicated because researchers have a remit as to why they're doing something. But also, when it comes to communicating to the public, we have to understand, well, if we take the academia and we say, okay, so this is the finding for this particular process. And I'm probably not going to make friends when I say this. There is something about we are more than hormones, we are more than brain scans, we are more than a number of self-referrals to mental health institute systems, we're more than the numbers of self-harm presentations in hospitals. And again, just to take that statistic, when I was looking into that research, it doesn't show whether those self-harm numbers are people revisiting, because the thing about self-harm is it tends to be a repetitive behaviour. And it's complicated because there's varying forms of self-harm, but numbers don't give the whole picture. And what I found is that's the moralistic, hyperbolic stuff that we've all zoned into because it's frightening. Look at the graph that goes up, or look at the brain scans. And I think we do a disservice as academics sometimes because we try to become... look at the numbers, look at this picture, look at this. We know more than you. Therefore, you know, we're not going to communicate it in a way that makes sense.
Yeah. It's making up stories from correlations that don't dive into details of why or how or what if and what happened, really.
To be honest, that's the biggest chapter in one of my books around the health and well-being industry. And that happens all the time. And, you know, just to give a reflection, I see so many children or young, it's mainly adolescents that come into the office that are changing their diets, changing what they're buying on the internet, you know, the kinds of foods they eat, the supplements they take, the exercise regimes, the food they then don't eat, because the health and wellness industry, specifically diet and exercise, is full of that correlational bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Kath, it's been such a delight talking to you. I've gained so much insight, and The work you're doing is so necessary in terms of educating others about trauma, especially parents, the teachers, therapists. Mm-hmm. Thank you for all that you do for cyberpsychology.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It was fabulous to catch up with you, and I hope to catch up with you again sometime soon.
Thank you.